Now please think to yourself that in order to bring all sentient beings to the state of Buddhahood, we need to study the Dharma. And that is the reason why we are studying the Dharma today. So please listen with this attitude of bodhicitta. The Dharma we are studying is the instructions on parting from the four attachments, the parting from the four attachments. The root verse was by the great Sakya master Sachin Gunga Nyimpo, and the commentary are these verses by Jessen Drapa Gyatso and his son. We've come to the third of the four. If you cling to your own aims, you don't have bodhicitta. But before we get to that, I want to make just a couple comments about speaking about a few things at lunch and talking about them. I wanted to make a correction. I realized that when I said a 1 in 40 billion chance, it's not a chance of the odds of being a termite, that's the odds of being an animal. Being a termite is a 1 in 500, you know, compared to being a termite, it's a 1 in 500 million chance. So it's a little bit better odds if you consider it just against the termites. But the big point about this, is that it's not like we're saying your next birth is a cosmic crapshoot with bad odds. Your next birth depends upon the actions you've done in the past. The actions that you've done in the past include the actions that you're doing now until the point that you die, basically. So that means, and the ones that you've done the most recently and the ones that you do with the most fervor and that you have the purest motivation are going to have the biggest result. And that's the important point about karmic cause and effect, is you have the chance. It's not like we are, you know, it's not like predestination in Calvinism where there are 72,000 names written down, you know, sometime back when God created the world. And those 72,000 are the only ones who are going to get into the, you know, get through the pearly gates. It's not like that at all. It's a question of you have the opportunity to do things that will give you a much better chance, if not guarantee, that you will be reborn a human in your next life, or even to be reborn in a pure realm of Dewa Chen. So it's not all hopeless. The numbers are mainly to really make you think about how fortunate you are. And if you don't do this, then it is the cosmic crapshoot. We know that we've had good karma to get this far. We can be certain of that, but how much of that good karma we've used up is a different matter. But what I like to always say is that the bank of karma has compound interest. So put your savings away now. So when we think about the suffering of samsara, one thing I didn't emphasize quite enough before lunch is it's not just the suffering of this life, it's the suffering of any situation that we get into. Even if you're born human, and if you're tremendously generous during this lifetime so that you're born an extremely wealthy human, one of the 1%, you are still going to experience suffering. Just because someone is rich does not mean that they're free of suffering. You may be, for various reasons, born extremely powerful in your next lifetime, if you're born human. But even that is going to be suffering. I mean, actually, if you think about people like Barack Obama or Vladimir Putin, it must be tremendous stress and pain to be in those positions, really difficult, you know, difficult situations. And often they end up doing things that are only going to cause them more pain in the future. If you were reborn in that situation, what is it going to be like for you? It'd be the same. Some ups, but a lot of downs and a lot of hardship. If you take a look, my family, we were all talking about presidential politics, and one of the things we were talking about is how, if you look at the presidents who looked young when they went into office, and look how they appear when they leave office. Bill Clinton was quite dashing. Was that a word that we used in 1992? And look how white his hair was at the end of 8 years. Even George W. Aged quite a bit. And now look at Barack Obama. He was pretty, you know, black hair, very handsome guy. He's still handsome, but he's noticeably got some gray in there. So, you know, it's a hard job. So no matter what position we're put in, we undergo suffering. And it's not just ourselves. I mean, if it were just ourselves, that would be one thing, but it's not. And no one in samsara can escape it except by following the path. And they can't follow the path if there's no one there to show them the path. So that's why the next point is, if you cling to your own aims, you don't have bodhicitta. So a lot of times I think we come into Buddhist practice And we hear about bodhicitta and we think, oh, I want to have bodhicitta. Well, the question is, do we really have bodhicitta? What is bodhicitta and do we really have it? So, basically, as it says here, maybe I'll just continue with the text before blabbing too much. When free of attachment, you pass to nirvana. Passing to nirvana, you gain happiness. The melody of experience free of the four attachments. And so, it is possible to achieve happiness from the path. We have good examples of this whom we can see. I mean, obviously, there's the example of the Buddha. There are the examples of all these great Sakya masters we're studying. There's the example of Trungpa Rinpoche and Kempo Karda Rinpoche. Like with Trungpa Rinpoche, when the Trungpa Monastery in 2010 was destroyed in an earthquake in Tibet, he wasn't particularly upset. I mean, he, of course, felt a lot of compassion for all those who were suffering, who had been killed or who were injured and so forth in it. But it wasn't like he was discouraged. You know, for himself, it wasn't a problem. He knew that that's just the nature of things. Actually, what Rinpoche said at that time is that meditating upon impermanence really helped him deal with it, made it a lot easier for him to deal with it. But he, on his own, for his own self, did not think to himself, oh no, everything I've done for the last 20 years is down the toilet in a single moment. He didn't think that way when the earthquake struck Nepal. I mean, he was obviously very concerned in reciting a lot of prayers and mantras on behalf of all of the people who were suffering in the earthquake. We all went outside and Rinpoche was up on the top of the hill in Namo Buddha, near but not too close to the Nundro, the preliminary retreat center, which was badly damaged. The only thing in Namo Buddha was. And he was sitting out there just reciting mantras all afternoon long as we sat there and then starting to organize ourselves. But he was, you know, for himself it wasn't an issue. So this is how it, you know, we can achieve results for ourselves by doing the practice. This is the melody of experience free of the four attachments, the joy that comes from practice. And I think as we go along the path, of course, until we get to such a level as Rinpoche or something like that, we can only guess at what their joy is like. But even along the path, there are points where we feel joy for ourselves. I think a lot of us do. I know I certainly have occasionally felt it. I mean, there are times when it's hard to, but, you know, when you feel that, but who are we doing it for? What are we doing it for? And so if we are doing it only for our own benefit, then there's no question that it's good, but it's definitely very liberated. So to liberate myself alone is no help. The beings of the three realms are my parents. How pitiful to want to be happy myself and leave my parents in the thick of suffering. So, if we were to follow the practices of what we call the foundation vehicle, we can achieve happiness for ourselves, the state of an arhat, where we never experience suffering again. And it's quite doable. There are many, many accounts of people who've done this throughout history. And there are many people, you know, a lot of people out there whom you wouldn't expect to be on that level, but do get to that level. In this lifetime, people who actually do some amazing things. But if you're only doing it for yourself, what about everyone else? How are they different from us? If you think about, okay, the example I brought up this morning, going to Hannaford's at 5 p.m. on, actually, probably 5 p.m. on Thursday is busier than 5 p.m. on Friday. Okay, I got the right night now. I'm trying to remember what it was like to live in North America. Yes, 5 p.m. grocery shopping at 5 p.m. on Thursday night is a very good time to go and to look at other people. And so when you go to the grocery store and you see all the other people, how different are you from them? A lot of it's kind of an accident. I mean, if I think about my own path and what led me to where I am and the incredible fortune that got me here, a lot of it is just decisions that, you know, I made not knowing what the consequences are that wouldn't seem at that point to have been at all related to what I'm doing now. And yet that ended up making all the difference. If I hadn't made those decisions, I wouldn't have gotten to the right place at the right time to be able to do what I'm doing now. So for all of us, it's like a lot of it is based upon the coincidence. And we can argue about whether that coincidence comes from karma or not. But one of the big coincidences for all of us is that we've met people like Trungpa Rinpoche, Kempo Kardar. And because we've met people like that, we've been able to do that. But for myself, before I even met Kempo Kardar Rinpoche, I met people like you at a study group in Hanover, New Hampshire. And, you know, one of them said, "Come and do you want to come and hear a Buddhist teacher?" It's like, yeah, why not? And there was Rinpoche, you know. You know, so, you know, I had no idea what I was getting into. But it's people like yourselves who are actually in a really good position to help other people. And those other people that you see at the grocery store at 5 p.m. on Thursday are no different from you in a fundamental respect. They want to be happy. They don't want to suffer. We're all the same. When we think about, what is it? IRS agents and CIA agents, they are the same. If we think about the people on any of the various warring factions in Syria, they are the same. They want to be happy and avoid suffering. The problem is that most of us don't know how to do it. And so the only way we can learn how to do it is if we come into contact with a genuine spiritual tradition. And Buddhism, you know, being Buddhist, I'm going to be partisan here. You know, we've got the best way. We'll just come right out. We've got the way that can actually lead you to enlightenment. So, but, you know, any of the spiritual traditions, of course, you know, yoga and Christianity and so forth, all the different traditions in Islam can bring a lot of solace to people, a lot of help to people. And if people follow them truly, they will behave well and bring themselves happiness in the future. But people need to come into contact with that. And that the only way that happens is by the other people around them. And so that's why, you know, in this community, you all, most of you here, I think, have already taken the Bodhisattva vow. And that doesn't mean that you're going to go out and be a first-level Bodhisattva who can emanate 100 emanations of yourself and do all these different miraculous things. What that means is that you can, through maintaining this center, through bringing people in by teaching the beginning class, you've got one starting in a week or two, I see. By doing this, you bring people in, you help people in the Dharma. This is the only thing that can happen, the only way that we can help people. And so we have to have the motivation to really do this. Often we look at other people and we see a big gulf between ourselves. We see a big gulf between ourselves and I'm not picking you on you, I'm just using this as the example. We see a big gulf between ourselves and the IRS agents. Well, the IRS agents, how different from ourselves are we? Are they? Really, they're just doing a job and they're supposed to do it, you know. You know, their job is, you know, not what we'd consider a pleasant job. But it's one that they're doing because they want a paycheck, because they think it's going to make themselves happy. How different is that from us? You can even take it on a more extreme level. I mean, how different are we from those people who have been taught that that jihad is the only way to bring happiness, and that if there is the final battle at the end of the world in some plain in Syria, that then Allah will come and rescue them and bring them to paradise, and they want to bring happiness for themselves and all true believers. How different is that from us? They want happiness. Their means are very different. Their means are very violent because they don't know. They've been taught incorrectly. But the essential wish is the same. So what happens is when our wishes to bring happiness to ourselves come at the expense of others, then it creates harm. So, I mean, the extreme example is the people in ISIS who think that by beheading innocent people, most of whom are not shown on YouTube and most of whom are not Western, not Westerners, they think that that somehow is going to bring them happiness. So, what can we do for? Obviously, for us to make contact with people, you know, if I got on a plane to Syria, if I weren't arrested before I got there, as soon as I got there, I would probably be seized and, you know, killed myself. So it's not like I can go over there as I am right now. Not like any of us can do that, probably. I mean, you have to be careful about it, but we have to have this attitude that we're doing it for the sake of all sentient beings. And this is going to include the beings we don't like as much as the ones that we do like. We think of ourselves as separate. And how separate are we really? The Yawan Karmapa talks about this a lot in terms of interdependence. Thich Nhat Hanh also talks beautifully about it. He calls it interbeing. And he often talks about the sheet of paper that comes from the sunlight and also from the farmer or the forester who took care of the trees, the person who cut it down, the people who worked in the paper mill as well. You know, and then you could go on the bugs in the soil. In some level, everything that we do is dependent upon anyone else. The things that we get in the grocery store, the food that we get in the grocery store, is not some discrete thing that just manifests on its own without anyone else's involvement. When we get to the heaven of the enjoying others' emanations or enjoying emanations, on those levels, yes, you could say it, but on our level, no. Here in the human realm, everything that we need to live comes from somewhere else, even down to the air we breathe, which depends upon plants. Those plants would not survive without insects. That whole ecosystem, so, you know, the whole web of life in Earth, and that's going to involve the beings that we don't like just as much as the ones that we do. So it's important to recognize this, and that we're all the same. And so if we were to just try to save ourselves from this situation and gain liberation for ourselves and leave everyone else there, we could do it. To a temporary level, we could achieve the state of cessation that is the goal of an arhat and pass into nirvana without remainder and remain in that state for eons upon eons. And even when we awoke from that state, we wouldn't experience any suffering. But at that point, we'd realize we hadn't done enough. So we might as well start now doing what we can. So it's how pitiful to want to be happy myself and leave my parents in the thick of suffering. You know, it's like, basically, you know, in school we learn we all want to make everyone happy and try to do what we can to help everyone be happy. And it's really what we have to do now. So may the suffering of the three realms ripen on me. May sentient beings take my merit. Through the blessings of this merit, may all beings awaken to Buddhahood. So this passage implicitly teaches meditating on the cause, loving kindness and compassion, and explicitly teaches the result, exchanging self for other. So the cause is having loving kindness and compassion. So loving kindness and compassion are the cause of bodhicitta, but they're different from bodhicitta. So loving kindness is the wish that other sentient beings be happy and have the causes of happiness. Right? Compassion is the wish that other beings be free of suffering and free of the causes of suffering. So, for example, wishing that beings be happy is, if we take Syria as an example, we can wish that all of the suffering people in Syria be safe, and free from danger, that they have plentiful food and water, that they have a prosperous and happy life. That's wishing that other beings be happy. That is the wish of loving kindness. We can have compassion for them, so we can wish that they be free of the suffering that they experience from war, We can wish that they be free from the causes of suffering, which are like waging war, killing, or even killing animals and so forth for their own meat or pleasure. We don't have to do it just on a remote example like sphere, you should also take a look at what's happening around you, because even in Portland, you can see people who are unhappy and unfortunate. There are people wandering around at many of the intersections for panhandling. And now there are various reasons why people are out there, but they're all, you know, it's not, I don't think it's anyone's favorite way of making a living and supporting themselves. And there are different other places. You can see it in your own lives and in your own families that everyone is experiencing various types of suffering. Everyone wants to be happy. And so wishing for them all to be happy. And not just stopping with humans, but also all of the different other beings that we can see and those that we can't see as well. So as much as we can, we need to develop this loving kindness and compassion. And then the result of having loving kindness and compassion is developing bodhicitta, where we're willing to trade ourselves for others, to exchange self for other. So this means that we value others more than ourselves, cherish others as more important than ourselves. And I think that this is a capacity that actually a lot of people have, even though it's kind of dormant in a lot of cases. But you hear of a lot of stories. I mean, the classic ones are of people in terrible situations who save their children before saving themselves. Or you will often read stories about, if you read about war, if you read any war novel, you'll read about someone, or even articles of war histories, or hear about people who sacrifice themselves in order to save the rest of the people in their regiment or whatever. Not that they're all engaged in, they're not engaged in virtuous activities, of course, but, you know, it's a very common willingness to sacrifice for yourself, for others. And I think a lot of us actually do have this willingness on a fundamental level. And I think if we found ourselves in an extreme situation, many of us would do it. But the point is that we need to increase this willingness to treasure others more than we treasure ourselves. And so the way we usually do that is we do it by the Tonglen meditation, studying the 7 points of mind training, practicing Tonglen, and developing bodhicitta. But then the question is, well, what is bodhicitta? So bodhicitta is generally characterized as, relative bodhicitta at least, is characterized as the wish to benefit, or the wish to bring, the wish to achieve Buddhahood for the sake of others. This is how it's described in the Clear Ornament of Clear Realization by Maitreya. So there are two aspects of it, two facets of bodhicitta. The first is the facet of compassion. So this is the wish to benefit others, the wish to doing it for others' sake. So the reason we need to achieve Buddhahood is not so that we can hang out in the pure realm. The reason we need to achieve Buddhahood is because we can do more. You know, I'm mentioning the things that you can do in your community now, even as ordinary people. Well, think how much more you could do if you were a Buddha. If instead of having to say, oh, I'm not certain about the answer to that question, I'm not certain, or thinking to yourself, I'm not sure how to respond to this person, if you just knew exactly what they needed and could do exactly what was right for them, which might not necessarily be what they think they want, but if you knew exactly what was best for everyone and could just do it for them without worrying about it, that's what a Buddha means. You know, the Buddha has the spontaneous activity to benefit other beings. And so, you know, that's what we need to achieve in order to do them. So the first aspect is the compassion of wanting to free all other sentient beings from this. But we don't know how to do that. We aren't like the Buddha. We don't have those means. So the other aspect we need is the wisdom, or the prajna, the intelligence that will allow us to do this. So these are the aspects we have to develop, the wisdom and the compassion. And then bringing these two together, we have Buddhahood. We can certainly help other sentient beings as we are now, but the further along we get in the past, the greater effect we can have in our teaching. And so the path to Buddhahood it's you know, when we follow the sutra vehicle, it's the teachings of the sutras, it's said to take a very, very long time, millions of lifetimes, three eons, three uncountable eons, which is an extremely long time. You don't even want to begin to count. It makes these numbers seem tiny. But practicing, but in order to practice this, really, we can accelerate. The more we develop our motivations now, the more we, and especially if we apply ourselves at the method of the Vajrayana, the more we have a strong motivation now, the further we'll get along in this lifetime. So it's very important for us to practice, do Tonglen practice, to do Chenrai Sik practice, to develop bodhicitta. And the wish to benefit all beings, and to do it really not for our own sake, but to do it for the other people's sake. Sometimes when we read teachings on Tonglen and on bodhicitta that are intended for Westerners, there's a large aspect of those teachings that sounds a little bit like self-help, a lot like self-help. If you have bodhicitta and do Tonglen, then you will feel a lot better, you'll have a lot less stress, you'll be able to deal with all situations and so forth. That is focusing on benefit for others. Now, there's no question that doing Tonglen that's focusing on the benefit for yourself, the benefit in this lifetime. So, in order to really have bodhicitta, we have to be doing it without attachment to this lifetime. Who cares if it reduces your stress in this lifetime? The important thing is the other being. Really, you know. It will stress, you know, of course it's going to have benefits in the lifetime. We don't want to do this, but that's not the point why you're doing it. If you really have bodhicitta, you're not going to worry about that. The other aspect is that we have to really have renunciation for it to be bodhicitta. If you don't want to free yourself from samsara, how can you want to free other people from samsara? If you think, you know, okay, as long as I'm able to keep going and visit Arabica coffee every Tuesday afternoon at 2 o'clock, I'll be fine. And then all you're going to think other people need is to go and visit Arabica coffee themselves. You know, it's not like that, really. That's just a temporary thing. So if you don't have a wish to free yourself from samsara, if you don't have real renunciation yourself, then it's going to be difficult to actually have bodhicitta. So this is why it's so important to keep meditating upon impermanence and the others of the four thoughts that turn the mind. So that's the teachings on bodhicitta. So that's the third. So if you are doing it for your own sake, so if you're doing it as self-help for this lifetime, then you don't have bodhicitta. If you're doing it in order to liberate yourself from samsara, you don't have bodhicitta. In this context of our current culture, the bigger danger is that we're doing is that we'd be doing it as self-help, frankly. And you will see a lot of references to Tonglen meditation in the popular literature that really do focus on it as, oh, it's a great method for stress reduction. I was in the airport in Vancouver a couple of weeks ago, and the person I happened to be sitting next to had just finished a mindfulness-based stress reduction or mindfulness workshop, which is basically using Buddhist meditation techniques as a way to benefit yourself in this lifetime. Now, of course, that's wonderful as far as it goes. But she was talking about Tonglen meditation as so relaxing, so calming, helped her deal with her own life. And this is what you read when you read about it in Western publications. So it's something that we have to keep in mind. It's not about making ourselves feel better now. It's about developing bodhicitta. And when you have bodhicitta that is strong enough, then you have to, it should be like you just see other people suffering and there's like nothing you can do but just practice, do your own practice as much as you can so that you can really develop the ability to truly help them in this lifetime right now. We don't have the ability to help people the way they need it right now. We need to develop that. And so when you see them and you feel that really strong urge, and it's hard to do that. I don't feel it all the time. I mean, I rarely feel it. I think I've maybe felt it, you know, a couple times. But that's it. You know, you've got this, you know, but there's other things. about bodhicitta, sometimes people think that it's going to be a big feeling that you have all the time, that you're going to be in this sort of ecstatic state of compassion all the time. But, you know, it doesn't work that way. There's got to be a quiet resolve. I'm going to commit myself to doing my practice and to finishing the number of repetitions that I need to do. I'm going to commit myself to doing X amount of shamatha meditation today, per day. I'm going to commit myself to meditating upon the four reminders as much as I can. You're going to make that commitment and follow that commitment. And what's the reason for doing that? The reason is to become a Buddha. So keeping that in mind as you do them. When you are doing each prostration, if you're doing the ngundro, then each prostration you're thinking, you're taking refuge for the sake of all sentient beings. They're all, in the visualization, you're prostrating and every sentient being in the universe, in all of the universes, is prostrating along with you. You are doing it for all of their sake. The bigger your motivation, then the bigger the result you're going to get out of it, the more powerful the practice is going to be. But that doesn't mean that you're going to be walking around in, you know, spiritual ecstasy all the time. Some days it's going to be pretty normal. You have to take that for account. But as long as you are able to keep at the practice, then that's what we need for bodhicitta. It's a strong motivation to keep us practicing. So, okay, well, I'm ranting today. So if you're doing it for your own sake, the fourth of the parting from four attachments is if you have grasping, it's not the view. Or if there is grasping, it's not the view. So grasping is actually there are different levels of it, ranging from very subtle attachment to very strong attachment. And so it's basically, if you have an idea of how things are or should be, and that idea is a conceptual idea that is not related to how things actually are, then it is going to prevent you from achieving enlightenment. So whatever the self is like, if there is grasping at the nature of phenomena, there is no liberation. So it doesn't matter. Like Rinpoche, when he talks about Mahamudra, often talks about it, says it doesn't matter what it's like. It doesn't. If there's a self, then so be it. If there's not a self, so be it. You just meditate, looking at the nature of what is. And so this is what we really need to do, whether we're doing it through Mahamudra practice or whether we're doing it through logic and study. However we're doing, no matter what our self is like, whether it exists, whether it doesn't exist, whether it's green, whether it is immaterial, whatever it is like, it does not matter. The important point is that if you grasp at it as being something, then you're probably grasping at it as being something other than what it is. And so, as it continues here, to explain this in detail, if you grasp at existence, there's no liberation. If you grasp at non-existence, there are no higher realms. Grasping at both is ignorance, so rest as best you can in the non-dual nature. So if you grasp at existence, this is traditionally taught as being the view of permanence. So the view of permanence means thinking that there is some self, some soul, that's going to go and be reborn. So one example of this would be the Christian conception of a soul, that is some sort of immutable essence of yourself that is then going to be born. Do they say born? That's going to go to heaven, basically. Go to heaven or go to hell. And we all hope to go to heaven, of course. So there's this idea of it being a me, a solid, or not necessarily material solid, but a real autonomous me that is independent and exists truly. It's independent, it's permanent. We have this idea that we are going to exist forever, this idea that there's some recognizable me that has always been me and will continue to be me forever into the future. So the other extreme is the extreme of non-existence. If you grasp at non-existence, there are no higher realms. So this is what in Buddhism is called a nihilistic view. the view that everything ends at the time of death. This is the idea, it's very similar to the materialist idea that is very common in scientific circles especially, or in contemporary society, that as soon as you die and all physical, all the physical things and the processes in the body stop, the mind stops, and you are dead. That's it. You're dead and gone. There's a beautiful phrase I saw about this in the Guardian a couple of years ago. What are we here? We're here for a brief moment in time bracketed by infinitudes of nothingness. That is, you know, it's a really beautiful phrase. The way he described it was Jonathan Franzen. Beautiful phrase, but is it really so? Do we really stop at the time of death? Does everything cease at the time of death? The problem with having that type of view in Buddhist thought is that it leads you to have a nihilistic view. Doesn't matter what you do. Because in truth, if it's all going to end in, either tomorrow or 40 years from now, however long we're going to be around, if it's all going to end then, you might as well enjoy yourself now, frankly. It doesn't matter what you're going to do. And it doesn't really matter what it does for other people. You know, if you enjoying yourself kills someone else, then they're free of suffering anyways. They're already dead. You know, so it leads, it can, if you get really craven about it. Now, I know that in our society, because of our different ethics, it works out differently. But there's a danger that the nihilistic view can lead you to. For example, you know, with a nihilistic view, you might then not see it as a problem that you're killing if you kill animals. You don't. You wouldn't, if you have a nihilistic viewpoint, and we're in this culture which hasn't considered animals to have much value anyways, other than what use there, then having a factory farm is, of course, completely reasonable. Why not? 60,000 hogs in a single facility? Why not? So these are the dangers of nihilism and eternalism. So grasping that both is ignorance. Things can't both exist and not exist at the same time. If you think that they can exist and both not exist at the same time, there's something wrong. That's just said to be ignorance. So rest as best you can in the non-dual nature. So this basically means what we really need to do is we need to learn how to rest in the nature of things as they are. And that's what we call the unified non-duality in general. So you can't say, like with ourselves, you can't say that we're permanent, autonomous things because we're changing all the time. That what ourself is today is a product of all of the causes and conditions, both that we're aware of and that we're not aware of, that have led us to be where we are now. And where we're going to be tomorrow may be similar to what we are, probably will be similar to how we are, and it'll certainly be part of the same stream of consciousness, but it's going to be different. It's not the same. And the longer the period of time goes on, then there's more change in your being. And so the being is always changing. It's always reinventing itself in every instant. And so trying to fix onto it as something autonomous and existent doesn't help us. But to deny that there's that continuum is also ignorance. And so we just rest. In Mahamudra we talk about the third of the lines of the third stanza of the Vajradhara lineage prayer. Whatever, as ones who rest simply, whatever arises, not altering in just that fresh essence of thought. So you just, there's no need to alter. You just rest in it as it is. And there's no need to make it into something. There's no need to remove anything bad. No need to add anything good. As it says in the Vajra Tantra, in this there's nothing to remove nor anything at all to add by viewing rightless rightly and by seeing rightly liberation. So you just rest at as it is. You don't need to bring in new qualities to make yourself a Buddha. You don't need to get rid of any bad qualities to make yourself a Buddha. You need to just rest in the awareness of your nature as it is, and by seeing that, then you can achieve liberation. So that's what it means by rest as best you can in the non-dual nature. Of course, it takes time to get there, so we have to do our practice. It takes time until you actually do it. So the next lines talks about this from the perspective of the mind-only practice. All phenomena are the sphere of mind. Without searching for a creator of the four elements such as Cha or Indra, rest as long as you can in the nature of mind itself. So Cha is the god in the Tibetan shamanistic Bön tradition. It's a name for god there. And Indra, of course, is the Hindu. And you can substitute Allah or Jehovah or whoever God is. Elvis. Whoever you consider to be God, you know, anyone that you consider to be any creator of the universe. Actually, everything that we perceive is a creation of our own mind. And when we talk about this, this is a difficult point for people to expect because you think it's some sort of strange Buddhist philosophy. Actually, I was introduced to the work of a Western doctor named Robert Lanza. I read a book of his called Biocentrism. He's got this kind of interesting theory that in many ways is parallel to mind-only Buddhism. It's basically an idealist philosophy, but what he explained came to it through following the logic of science. And so if we take an example of basically what he's saying is that everything we experience is actually a construction of our minds. He says a construction of our brains and neural networks. I'm going to say mind. For example, when you hear a sound, like you're hearing my voice, what is my voice? Well, it's me pushing air through my vocal cords, and the way I push it through somehow makes it vibrate, and then moving my tongues, it changes the way it vibrates, and there are these vibrations in the air, which are really just, you know, little puffs of air that are coming back and forth, that are moving towards you, and they eventually find their way into your ear canals. This sounds so, I shouldn't use this example, it just sounds so lewd. The puffs of air are finding their way into your ear canals and making the tympanum vibrate. And this makes those bones go clatter, clatter, clatter. And tickles the hairs on the inner ear. Or something. I don't know. I don't remember exactly how it works. And when it tickles the hairs on the inner ear, then some sort of a signal is brought into the back, you know, somewhere in the brain. And then the mind sort of puts a whole bunch of these signals together and says, oh, that's David Karmachipal's voice. What is there actually? Is there my voice actually? It's just air vibrating back and forth. So that perception of my voice is actually constructed in your mind. When you look at something, you look at the window and the window blinds. Well, what are you looking at? What are you seeing? You're seeing sunlight that's filtered through the blind, and then somehow that light is refracted through your eyes into your retina, and then it goes back into your brain, and your brain processes it. Now, the white, what is the white from? I mean, this is pretty basic science. I even remember being taught this back in grade school or high school or whenever. Is that white because there's something inherently white about that? It's white because it's absorbing, according to physicists, it's absorbing all of the different frequencies at equal amounts, and so because it's got equal amounts of all the frequencies, it appears to you to be white. Actually, there's a fairly narrow spectrum of electromagnetic radiation that we see. It's, I don't remember the numbers, but 400 to 600 whatevers, something like that. And when there are equal amounts in there, then something appears to be, of all of the frequencies in that spectrum, that appears to be white to us. If there's more on the slower, low end of that frequency, it appears to be red. Oh, my robes, I don't have to hold up this. Look at me, I'm red. You know, I've got all this, you know, so all of these robes, what's red about it? Nothing. It's that the light that is reflected off of it, more of the blue the higher frequency light is being absorbed and the lower frequency red light is being reflected and goes into your eye. But actually, it's just a question of what frequency are the waves moving. There's nothing red about this. There's nothing inherently red about it. When you see it as red, that's just your mind putting it together, getting all this information from the faculties and putting it together as an appearance of red. So the appearance of red, there's nothing inherently red about my robe. So all of the appearances are appearances of mind. And this is something that, we often talk about this in Buddhism, talk about this in the context of Mahamudra, where we talk about examining the mind and appearances, where we look to see where is the mind that is aware of the appearance, and trying to locate the two. But we can also look at it in terms of modern physics. And that's only dealing with classical physics. When you start adding in quantum physics, it gets even more, more clear that it's all just in our mind, because all of these particles, the electromagnetic radiation, is it a particle or is it a wave or is it both? Is it a probability function? And you start looking for it and you you only find what you're looking for. So when you start looking at everything in terms of quantum physics, there's nothing there except what is being perceived, and that perception is inextricably alters or unavoidably alters what is being perceived. So you can think about it in terms of, if you just think about what modern science is teaching us, it really comes down to the same point as this, that everything we perceive is nothing other than a construction of our minds. So appearances, so this teaches the gradual path common to the mind only bodhisattvas. Next is the particular path of the Mahayana middle way. Appearances whose nature is illusion and the nature that arises interdependently are ineffable, so rest in the ineffable nature. So the comments here I didn't mention it before, the comments were added by Sakya Pandita, who was a great Sakya master of the 13th century. So rest in the ineffable nature, resting is the shamatha aspect. The inside aspect is establishing that appearances are the object of mind. Appearance of the object are mind. So this is really the same thing as we just talked about. Everything that we appear is an appearance that occurs in our mind. All our perceptions. There is nothing outside, independent of that, that can exist independently of that. And so these are all like illusions. When you're watching a movie on your phone or on your computer, or you're looking at on something, you've got various different, something's being downloaded by whatever internet voodoo to your device, and you're watching these colors and that are moving on the device. It's really just a whole bunch of different pixels that are showing in different colors at different times. And they sort of come together in what our brains will assemble as an image. And then we think, oh, I'm watching the debate. You're watching your iPad. You're not watching the debate. Your iPad has a simulacrum of the debate. Or you think you're watching a movie or whatever. Actually, you're just watching various, lights that are being shown through a piece of glass, frankly, when it comes down to it. And so all the appearances that we see are actually the same, that they're illusory. And so they have no real nature of their own. So real nature, when we say that things don't have a real nature, that means that we don't think of we think of things as being autonomous and real, as being having a solidity and existence of their own, but they don't. There's nothing that is independent of anything else. Everything is related. It might be a very tortured path to get to it being related, but there is a connection between ourselves and everything else in the universe. Particularly if you start thinking about things being just appearances that occur in our minds. But even if you don't think about it that way, if you think about it on a simpler level, you know, the clothes that we wear, where do they come from? Who made the fabric? What is the fabric made out of? What did that come from? And if you go back far enough, you see that it's just this huge web of all sorts of things. Well, maybe these robes that I'm wearing now, I got them in India, and there's someone in India who also tailored your clothes. Or who, you know, maybe the factory that makes my clothes bought the cotton from a certain community that also makes the cotton, grew the cotton that goes into your clothes. So maybe there's some connection between our clothes, especially in this global world. We might think that we have no connection to the civil wars in Nigeria and in the Democratic Republic of Congo and that whole area. But we all use devices of, well, we call them devices now, we all use technology, you know, iPhones, iPads, computers, and so forth, that contain rare earth minerals. And where are those mined? They're mined in Africa. And it's the mining for the greed over the profits from those mines that has led to a lot of the conflict in those areas. In Syria, the conflict in Syria, you could say that it has nothing to do with us, that we bear no culpability for the matter, but one of the big contributions to the conflict starting in Syria is that they ran out of water because of climate change. Climate change happened to a large part because of our use in the development world of developed worlds of too many hydrocarbons and causing global warming. Before the developed world even started, we were well ahead on hydrocarbon usage in this, particularly in American society. So you can see that our consumer society, although not visibly linked, is actually indirectly linked to the suffering in Syria. And so on, with all of these different things in the world. We're all linked, we're all interdependent. And because of that, if we think of ourselves as being discrete, I have nothing to do with the conflict in Syria, that we're never going to be able to do anything to either develop true compassion within ourselves or to ever be able to do anything to help anyone in such a situation. So that's why it's so important for us to really think about how connected we are to everyone, all beings in the world. We might also think that, you know, we're not connected to ticks. But actually, we're probably quite dependent upon. I haven't thought it through enough to think of some way that we could say that we're connected to ticks, that we depend upon ticks. But there's no being in this world that we don't have some sort of dependent relationship with. And so this is why it's so important for us to develop compassion, develop bodhicitta, and do everything we can in this lifetime, not just for our own sake, not just for self-help in this lifetime, but really to benefit all sentient beings. What choice do we have? If we don't do it now, how long is it going to be before we get this chance again? So it's really important for us to do this now. So By the merit of this virtue of explaining, the parting from the four attachments, may all seven types of beings be brought to Buddhahood. So the seven types of beings refer to the six classes of samsara, plus the bardo beings. So you know, the hells, hungry ghosts, animals, humans, demigods, gods, plus bardo beings. Sometimes the bardo beings are also included in the realm that they're going to be born in next, but here they're counted separately. So, this morning I went a little over, and this afternoon I finished a little bit quicker, but that leaves us more time for question and answer this afternoon. So if you have any questions, please feel free to ask. Amy, you've already asked, so in the back, I'm sorry, I don't remember your name. Okay.
What aspect, when our physical bodies die, what aspect of our nature enters the bardo? Mm-hmm. We've been reading and discussing this, whether it's a dharmakaya or a sambha.
Svabhavakaya.
Of what aspect of our Buddha nature, if it is part of our Buddha nature?
Mm-hmm. Okay. when we pass away, what happens? We have five aggregates, right? So the form, forms of feeling, perceptions, formations, and consciousness. The form body is the body, the physical body, the form. And so when we perish, that perishes, that ceases. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the other four cease. In fact, if you look at what happens to a physical body at the moment of death, then that matter in the body is then reused. If the body is buried and not soaked in formaldehyde too much ahead of time, then it rots and becomes part of the earth, and then it grows up again. If you burn it, then much of it goes off as gas in the air. The rest is ashes that are then scattered or whatever. So the physical aspect, we see that the physical parts of the body continue. In the same way, unless you have overcome the causes, the consciousness and the associated mental factors are all going to continue as well. So, because we have so that's what continues. It's like if you look at yourself, we've got the body and we've got our consciousness. And each moment of consciousness leads to the next moment of consciousness, and to the next, and to the next. And so you can follow that line of consciousness back all the way back to the first consciousness in this body, which would be the consciousness at the moment of conception. And then did that come from nothing? Well, nothing comes from nothing. It's not like we, you know, there's some God who says Shazam, and then all of a sudden, or let there be life, mm-hmm. or whatever. It's like it comes about because of causes and conditions, from an infinite cycle of causes and conditions. That consciousness has an infinite cycle that varies over lifetime. And in fact, the consciousness changes radically over the courses of our lives. We can see that in this life. And if you think about the way you thought about things, I mean, I don't remember how I thought about things as a little child, but you know, the way I thought about things as sort of, you know, as a kid, how I think about thought about them as an adolescent, how I think about things now. There's been great changes in how my consciousness goes. We can even see the changes in the consciousness over the course of a day. One moment you might be very happy, the next moment very sad. But there's a continuum from each moment to the next. And that continuum is self-perpetuating. And so it keeps going and going and going. And then at the moment of death, it's delinked from the physical body. But it continues as long as we have the condition of craving propelling it onto the next consciousness, then it'll keep going and then eventually take a new body, which is new rebirth. So that is the consciousness and the associated mental factors that continue after death into the bardo state, where you don't have a physical body, but then you have a mental body, and then into the taking rebirth in your next lifetime in another physical body. So that consciousness in its essence is nothing other than emptiness. It is nothing other than the clarity of mind. It is that union of clarity and emptiness. But it's for an ordinary sentient being, it's ignorant. There's the aspect of ignorance. It does not know what's going on. Because of that ignorance, it doesn't recognize that its own nature is no different from the Dharmakaya. It doesn't recognize the Dharmakaya aspect. And so it is then propelled into the next lifetime. So that's what goes on to the next life. I think Amy had a question, and then you.
It's related.
Okay.
You've sort of answered it, but I always come back to this because I guess because I don't quite have a clear sense inside my head, but. So you said that Christian idea of a soul is not something about that is I'm not sure exactly how you said it, but something about that is too solid, like the concept is too solid. So what is it that the teachers say that we have that the karma the karma attaches to, or that guides the karma into a new rebirth and then expresses itself? If we don't have some essential meanness to carry that karma with us.
If there were an essential meanness, we could see it. We could sense it somehow. We could perceive it somehow. In the Christian idea, there is a soul that is not necessarily perceptible by ordinary senses or by our own self-awareness. There's an idea that there's an essential me, and there's a soul that will then be reborn in heaven, or go to heaven, I should say. So that's an idea of there being some essential me that is somehow unchanging. But when you look at it, at our own experience, there is the me that we have in this very instant. Is this the same as the me that had lunch earlier today? The me that had lunch 2 hours ago, or 2.5 hours ago, was eating. This me is not. They're different. They're changing all the time. Now, because there's a continuum between the two, or an even better example of that is there's the me who was a baby about that long at one point. I did not speak Tibetan. Right now, who am I? If you say, who am I now? I am a monk. I am a translator. I speak Tibetan. I speak English. I do all sorts of things. When I was a baby, all I could do was go wah and suck and poop. That's about all I could do. I couldn't do any of it. So there's a different, it's a different person. But because there's a continuum, that baby in each instant changed because of causes and conditions. The food I was given, the care of my parents, the care of my and support of my community, the opportunities I've been given over the course of a life, that then that became me now. Is there some essential David? You know, what would have been essential to me? You know, people who knew me when I was a teenager would have said, oh, he's going to be playing the cello his whole life. I haven't touched a cello for years, not since the last time I visited Beijing. You know? So that's not an essential part of my life. Is being a monk an essential part of my life? No, because I was not always a monk. So it's changing from each moment to moment to moment. Then as we die, that continuum and that circumstances of changes is going to continue. Our the karma, what the karma does really is it like it habituates you. And so that creates the patterns of thought that then will reflect back to you as the appearances, remembering that appearances are just products of our mind, product of our fevered imagination, we could say. They're just product of our mind. And so what we do affects how we think, affects how we create those appearances. And so that then creates the appearances of the bardo and the next life. But in each moment, it's changing from one moment to another. You don't need to have a particular autonomous me to go through all of this to make it work. It's like you've got a collection of stuff that's going.
But something's going.
On a relative level, you'd say it is something, but where is it? What is it? I mean, you can't say if something's going, is it singular or is it multiple? What is it that's going? Is it my I don't know, what would it be? My blue eyes? No, because when I die, those aren't going to go on. It's not an aspect of my body. What aspect of my mind would it be? I'll probably forget. You know, when I take my next birth, I'll probably forget all the languages because I'll be reborn a squid or something, I don't know. You know, so that's not that. What is it? There's no essential quality of me that is necessarily going to be that me in the next life or that was me in a previous life. In my previous lifetime when I was, when I was a squid, for example, I'm sure I must have been a squid, although I don't remember it. What quality of that squid is the same as me? There's nothing the same. But there's a continuum of one moment leading to the next. It's like, if you want to take an example, you've got the physical matter that's, you know, in soil. It's absorbed by a plant. It goes through the process of becoming a plant and then some of it grows into a seed, and then that seed falls down, into the ground and sprouts and gathers new matter and becomes a new plant that has a new seed, that has a new plant, makes a new plant, and so forth. It's, you know, the matter that's in there is changing all the time, but there's a continuum that you can see. So it's similar with our consciousnesses. Yes. And I don't remember your name either.
Susan.
I'm sorry. Susan, okay.
So just briefly to get to the ticks.
Mm-hmm.
You were talking about ticks and how they connect to everything.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of birds eat ticks.
Yeah.
And birds pollinate, you know, flowers and vegetables.
All right, okay, good.
Yeah. Contribute to that. So. Anyway, so when you talk about the creation, everything is a creation of the mind.
Mm-hmm.
That's also true of feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And I find it's very, 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 very hard for people to get their head around that.
Touch. You mean the tactile sensations?
No, that you know, if everything is a creation of the mind, feeling is also a creation of the mind. And
mm-hmm.
when you work with people who have incredibly intense feeling, whether mm-hmm. they hate something, whether they, you know, they can't stand their ex-husband, or they can't stand their ex-wife, or they're crazy about this person, and they just can't get enough of them, or whatever it might be,
mm-hmm.
okay? It's very, very difficult. I've worked with people,
mm-hmm.
and it's very, very difficult to say, well, I mean, it would be, you know, it's very, very difficult to say, but let's let go of that for a minute, or that's a creation of your
yeah.
mind, or, you know, that's an extraordinarily long process
yeah.
for many, many people.
Mm-hmm.
Although, you know, as a practitioner, you kind of get that. You know?
Right.
So, just wondering if you have any tips or pointers about that.
Well, there are two aspects of it. There's working with your own emotions, and there's working with other people's emotions. In terms of this sort of analysis of looking at things as being, where is the feeling? I mean, for your own practice, looking at your emotions and your feelings, where are they if they're not in your mind? You know, where is anger except in your mind? Part of that you can do through, like, Mahamudrex, the taking the afflictions as the path, the instructions on doing that, which are in the Kenpo Gongshars, in the Vivid Awareness book. There are things like that instructions like that you can use. But you can also just think about it logically on your own. Well, where is it if it's real, if it's something other than you, if it's something that seized you, where is it other than your mind? Really, it's actually a question of the habituation of your mind. And so at the same time as you, for working for yourself, the same time as you engage in things like the Mahamudra or in these sort of logical sorts of analyses that I've been talking about today, you can also work in training yourselves in the opposites of those. If you have a problem with, name your problem, you know, anger, the opposite of anger is loving kindness. So you work on loving kindness, developing your loving kindness. You can work on developing your compassion. If you have a problem with pride, you can meditate upon the equality of yourself and other sentient beings, the fact that we all want the same things. If you have a problem with envy, you can meditate upon rejoicing in other people's having good and bounty and pleasant happiness in their lives. If it's jealousy, you know, over some sort of relationship, you can first of all meditate on relief that you're not involved in their relationship, and second of all, in joy that the other people who are involved, may they be happy, and things like that. If you meditate upon those qualities, then that also works as a counteracting that. In terms of working with other people, I mean, I assume that you're in some sort of helping or healing profession, shall we say? And in that case, then there's a lot of good in Western psychology, in the Western teachings, and helping people to deal with these, to help them loosen the grips. Because when someone is really seized by hatred for someone else, then they cannot immediately see through it and cannot immediately see the equality of self and other and all that. It's very difficult. One tool in that particular instance that will help is to teach them how to do the loving-kindness meditation, particularly as described in the Theravada tradition, the metta practice. It's very helpful for people, and I think a lot of psychologists use it in their practice to help people loosen, you know, develop the loving-kindness, because that, them developing, just as it helps you, it also helps others develop those qualities and loosen their that. But there are the tools there. And only when people are really able to do it can they be, you know, and when they're willing to do it, can they be introduced into Buddhism, Buddhist teachings. If someone's not ready and willing, then there's nothing you can do. There are people who we can't help right now, not through Buddhism. You know, if we went over to talk to some of those guys in ISIS, assuming that we were able to survive this, we wouldn't be able to get through to them. There's no way. There was an article I saw online in The Guardian about someone who had talked with, maybe it was another article, anyways, I spend too much time looking at news online, and this article was someone who had talked with suicide bombers. By the time they've been trained to be a suicide bomber, it's too late, and it's very difficult to actually get through to that person. But I think using Western techniques that you're trained in otherwise to help people calm down, and then if they're ready for it, introducing them to some Buddhist ideas is very, very, is a good way to do it.
Thank you.
Yes.
Going back to Amy's question, because it's still vague in my mind. When, at the time of death, when the forms split and the physical body falls apart, and the rest goes off as a continuum. isn't your karma, negative and positive, that you've, that's attached itself to your continuum? Isn't that continuum sort of a self continuum? I mean,
you can call it whatever you like.
It's a particular continuum that has certain karma attached to it.
Karma isn't attached. It's not like when you do an action. It's not like you've got a big bag on your back, and you do a bad action, you get a big black coal, and you do a white action, you get a lump of sugar. It's not like that. It's like the actions that you do make an impression on your body, on your mind. That impression on your mind, it's like if you have a stream, you throw a rock in the stream, and it's going to create eddies further downstream that will then affect the current. The bigger the rock, the more effect it's going to have downstream. So that action that you're doing is like throwing a rock in the current. If you throw in all sorts of rocks, then you're going to, you know, create a really bad situation. If you do good actions and do them in a proper way, then you can direct it, direct that stream where you want it to go, which is to a good lifetime. But it's not like it's something separate from yourself, there, because you can't find it anywhere. Where is that karma? You know, it's not like, I joke about the bank of karma, but where is it? You know, it's not anywhere. We say the storehouse consciousness, the alaya vijnana, the, you know, the ground consciousness. Well, where is that? It's nowhere separate from your mind. And that's really that is also momentary. It's creating itself from moment to moment to moment to moment. So, it's just a collection of things that are together and that are moving. And so you can say there's a collection, you can give that collection a name. If you want to give that collection the name, the self, then there's, in one sense, no harm to it. But when you start naming things and saying, this is that, then you start to lose the reality that it's just a bunch of interdependent things that are moving somewhat together. And that then you, you know, because it's the basis of your consciousness, you say me. We mistake it for a me. But if you can rest within the non-dual nature, then you can be liberated from that cycle of causes and conditions. It's a hard one to think about. The idea of on a relative level, we're talking about the duality of mind and body. Mm-hmm. And that's a hard thing for a lot of us to accept in this culture. But I think if you read stories about out-of-body experiences and so forth, then it's pretty clear that mind and body are not inextricably linked. It's, you know, we're brought up in school and reading science pages and newspapers to think that the mind is merely the activity of the brain. But if that is so, then how do people have out-of-body experiences when they're under cardiac stress and all the activity in the brain ceases? How does that happen? So there's clearly something that's moving separately from the body. That's what we call the mind and mental factors. But it's not like there's one thing. We've got, you know, our consciousness, we've got, you know, the traditional classification, we've got the mind consciousness, the eye, ear, nose, tongue, and body consciousness, six consciousnesses, plus in some, the seventh and eighth consciousnesses, so you've got six or eight consciousnesses, however you decide to count them. Each of those consciousnesses has different mental factors, you know, the different feelings that we're talking about, they're momentary events in our consciousnesses. And so that's, you know, if there is going to be a single solid, if there's going to be an if there is going to be an identifiable me at the time of death, there would have to be one now. And so where is it?
It's more in terms of how do you answer when someone asks you, explain what happens. It's hard to put words to it. I think it's describing something that's not describable to you.
Yeah, it's just a continuum. It's not like there's some single thing. I think that's the easiest answer to understand is it's a continuum. It's like a stream. Maybe, you know, it's a stream that's going down and the death is like the waterfall to the next level. Oh, yes.
In terms of going forward in my life,
mm-hmm.
as of today, whatever, 320, would you say the best way to move forward is to really question my motivation in whatever I do, whether it's professionally or family or coming here, or what is the pure motivation? Would that help me move forward as best as I can?
Yeah, well, I think generally, paying a lot of attention to your motivation is very important. And when you have the good motivation, then you naturally will you'll do well and be helpful and be good, be a good person in all of these different contexts. The motivation, it's one thing, it's not necessarily to challenge yourself in each moment, but to check yourself. And it's very easy to fall into the other, you know, the traps of acting on the afflictions. In the context of what we're talking about now, of the parting from the four attachments, the most important thing is to not worry so much about, of course, to always have a positive motivation, wishing to help yourself and others. But the most important thing is to remember the four reminders, to remember the precious human body, and making use of that precious human body, to remember that it's not going to last forever, so remembering death and impermanence, remembering that the nature of samsara is suffering, and remembering that because of karmic cause and effect, we have an opportunity to change how things will go in the future, and taking care of those. And so looking at all aspects of your life, not just checking your motivation, but taking a lesson from everything you see around you. It's really important. Sometimes we think of Buddhist practices, you come and you meditate and then you go off. But actually, if you use your entire life as as a reminder for the nature of how things are, and then forgetting about the stories and sitting down and doing your practice, then it'll be much more powerful. And so you can use the time in the classroom, the time dealing with your family, to look at things. You can look at the changes. You know, your children were wee, beautiful, blonde-haired kids, and now look at them, they're huge. You can look at, you know, you can look at all of the different aspects of your life and see that, look at that to see the impermanence and changing in life. You can look at the ups and downs in the life, looking at the downs of life, remembering that this is just the nature of how things are. Well, I think maybe that's enough for this afternoon. I'd like to thank you very much for having me come again. I'm very happy to see many of you again, and some of you, I think it might be the first time, if it's not the first time I've met you, I apologize terribly, I meet too many people, but to have a good chance to get to know all of you again, and I appreciate that you've come and taken a whole Sunday to come here and think about the Dharma, and I hope that this is helpful for you. So thank you very much for coming. So we have a dedication prayer somehow. Closing. That would do it.
Sipe so